You are listening to So What, a podcast from Canadian Mennonite University. CMU is in Treaty 1 territory, Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm your host, Jonas Cornelson, in Treaty 7, Calgary, Alberta. So What is a quarterly podcast where I look at public lectures and events from CMU and ask how these academic attitudes apply to life off campus. This episode's going out in the beginning of September, and no matter how long it's been since your last back-to-school experience, I'm going to take you right back there. Perhaps to what you dread most about getting back into the classroom. It's time for a poetry lesson. Okay, for those of you who haven't shut off your device or thrown it out the window in fear, here's a bit of relief.
What if we start with poetry that doesn't scare us and that usually doesn't get talked about in university?
Poetry that doesn't scare me? Okay, I'm listening. That's CMU professor of English and co-lead singer of prof rock group The George Herberts, Dr. Paul Dick. Paul was giving an open lecture within CMU's relatively new Ways of Knowing course. The course is taught collaboratively by several faculty members, with the goal of showing first-year students how different academic disciplines offer insight into the same big questions. And when I say big questions, I mean really big. In fall 2023, the central theme question for the course was, "What are people for?" It's unlikely we'll answer that whole question today. We won't even cover Paul's whole lecture, titled Humanity's Poetic Vocation. No, I want to return to Paul's question about starting with poetry that doesn't scare us, specifically the poetry of breakup songs. I want to ask, what can academic analysis teach us about the power of pop music poetry? And on the flip side, what does the power of this more popular poetry reveal about the limits of academic thinking? To start on these questions, let's get Paul Dick's thoughts on what poetry does, perhaps better than any other kind of written or oral expression, precisely by being less straightforward.
One problem with poetry is that it scares us. It's often hard to understand. It goes out of its way to be unclear. And why can't it just say what it means? I want to plant an idea here and return to it later. Poetry's capacity to say what cannot otherwise be said is one of its most important qualities. A good reading of a good poem makes something available to us that previously did not seem available. As Theseus scoffs, he's a good rationalist, in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, poets give to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. You know, you take something that doesn't exist and you make it seem as if it does exist. Poetry makes something present, something that was elusive or absent or otherwise out of reach in space and time. Theseus, a good rationalist, is entirely sure he doesn't need it. But he is in love, and so.
At the risk of oversimplifying, this clip makes me think that perhaps asking what a poem means is the wrong question. At least if we're talking about meaning in a rational sense, like the character Theseus. Maybe we should ask what a poem feels like, how it helps us become aware of feelings that can't be fully accessed with rational thinking, like being in love, poor Theseus. Or, as in the song we'll turn to now, the feeling of emptiness left by love that's been lost.
I can eat my dinner in a fancy restaurant, but nothing, I said nothing can take away this blues, 'cause nothing compares to you.
Nothing compares to you. Number 2, letter U, if you want to look it up later. Sung by Sinead O'Connor, written by Prince. To get at what this song means, or feels like, as an example of poetry, we're going to hear Paul talk about the way it uses some of poetry's fundamental building blocks, rhythm, rhyme, and repetition, and what those building blocks do in us as we listen.
I've asked you to listen to Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You. And you may well be thinking, Paul, that's cheating. That's not a poem, it's a song. And that's true, at least the last part. Nothing Compares to You is definitely a song. And songs have rhythm. And if we stop and look, we could see that the words to this song already have rhythm, even before the music starts. Or, to put another way, the words themselves already have music. The lyrics to this song, as with practically all popular music, have rhythm. They cannot help but have rhythm, because our everyday language already has rhythm. It's so deeply habitual, so deeply embodied, that it can only be noticed when you take special effort. But poetry, including song lyrics, we might say is a technology for noticing rhythm, and to go further, for enjoying the rhythm, and for practicing rhythm. It's like a practice of becoming rhythmical, or of being rhythmical. We are already deeply rhythmical creatures. Our heartbeat, our pulse, is our signature sign of life. In poetry, and especially sung poetry, we get in rhythm with another voice, and we exercise something that we otherwise take for granted. That's rhythm. You may have already noticed that the song uses another element of poetry, and that's rhyme. And it uses rhyme really effectively. And the song also uses repetition. It's not simply saying what it means, it's saying it over and over again. It's saying it over and over again with a building meaning, right? And there's an accumulation of meaning that becomes more than what it simply says.
So rhythm, rhyme, and repetition are some of the ways poetry builds a kind of meaning and impact different from, say, an essay, lecture, or a podcast. Poetry taps into some of the deepest elements of our humanity, even our heartbeat, to express through words things that are ultimately beyond words. Of course, with music, the instrumentation and arrangement are a huge part of that expression. The lyrics of Nothing Compares to You would be profoundly less effective over, say, a polka beat with tubas and accordions. But let's just assume any half-decent musician already knows that and continue focusing on the text. I've been talking about what a poem means compared to what it feels like. Paul does this by comparing a poem's meaning with its effect.
If we start to separate it out, we can talk about the song's meaning as one thing and the song's effect as another. What is the song saying to you, and what is the song doing to you? The first we can sum up. It's a breakup. The singer misses the ex. She is unhappy. But what is the song doing to you? It is giving you feelings, feelings that may run very deep. Some songs touch a nerve. We hear them and they become part of us. I want to propose to you as a premise of this talk that when a song has become part of you, there is poetry at work. I'm not proposing to you that you ought to start knowing things poetically. Rather, I begin by saying that you already know things poetically. And it is this knowing that you already do that I'd like us to think about here.
You already know things poetically. This will come up in more detail later, but it has a lot to do with how a poem's meaning to you isn't just about what the words describe. While the lyrics of this song say something specific that you may not have experienced, they also express deeper feelings of heartbreak and longing that you likely have experienced in some way. When poetry is at work, as Paul says, it connects the poet and the listener through these shared feelings as much as the text itself.
Now, an essential mystery of poetry is that it is both intensely personal and in its very nature a shared experience. The more effectively the poet puts words to what they are feeling, the more those words affect the reader. Paradoxically, I cannot express myself as an individual without involving you. There is no individuality possible without relationship. This song delivers a message with astonishing economy, capturing the speaker's state of existence and imprinting it on us with a breathtaking clarity. My point is that it is precisely as the words take poetic exactness, as they exactly get right the singer's heart, they land in the listener's heart. Again, expressions of the self do not happen in a vacuum. I cannot express myself without having an effect on another person. Thus, poetry, even as it is personal, is a profoundly shared form. I think we already know this about other ways of knowing, about other forms of language. We naturally think about scientific language as communicative and public. The strange thing I'm talking about is that the seemingly private language of poetry is, in a meaningful, demonstrable, everyday sort of way, all the more profoundly public. For example, Taylor Swift writes songs that come from her own personal experience, and they become the songs of countless fans, expressing something personal for each one, and something relational.
I think that last point Paul made helps answer the question we started with about the power and value of pop music as poetry. While many forms of communication, like scientific reports and academic papers, are meant to be public in the sense of wide distribution, they aren't nearly as vulnerable, and so more profoundly public, as Paul says, as one person allowing their private emotional experience to connect with another's, as with a singer and listener. Maybe that's a shortcoming of academic literature, but to me it's also just a great feature of poetry and pop music worth celebrating. Since we're talking about personal experience, let me illustrate this with a personal example. I was raised on the music of Bruce Springsteen, largely thanks to my dad. Springsteen is nothing if not a profoundly good storyteller, and the scenes and characters in his songs became the soundtrack of my youth, shaping how I understood my experiences of growing up. But here's the thing. My actual experiences are nothing like what you'll hear in a Bruce Springsteen song. I didn't live in a struggling American small town, get laid off from my construction job, get drafted into the U.S. Army, or drive muscle cars in the hopes of impressing women named Mary or Wendy. As far as I know, my dad didn't have many of these experiences either, except maybe the car stuff. We've already discussed that what a song says can be different from the effect that it has, and this is related to another aspect of poetry that Paul brings into his thoughts on Nothing Compares to You, that poems can, and perhaps always do, talk about more than one thing at a time. With this song, the layers go even deeper, because, as I said earlier, it was written by Prince but performed most famously by Sinead O'Connor. The same words expressed different longings in writer and singer. Sadly, in this case, there was significant conflict between them, which we don't have time to discuss fully. But as Paul says here, this sharing of words, even with such tension, shows another key aspect of what poetry and breakup songs can do.
Prince and Sinead O'Connor did not become friends when she made his song famous. They became strange to each other, even as they shared the same words. This deeply personal conflict between the two comes back to another important aspect of poetic knowing, which is poetry's capacity to speak of more than one thing at a time. Sinead O'Connor died earlier this year, and may she rest in the peace of God. And there were lots of articles about her, including about her conversion to Islam. I knew the one album with this song, the album I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, from 1990. And I did listen to that album a lot, but I hadn't paid a ton of attention since, other than knowing her as a fearless critic of abuses in the Catholic Church, particularly in her native Ireland. On the whole, though, I suppose I thought of her as a secular singer. But the moment I thought about her being on a lifelong spiritual journey, then the song Nothing Compares to You started to read differently. One of the central convictions of Christianity and of Judaism and Islam is that the world is full of things that, no matter how good, cannot replace God or a relationship with God. That is, if we live in the world placing our hopes, our love only in the world, we will come up empty. In this particular sense, the world offers what we might call false consolations. Thought of in this sense, the song puts the point very well. Yes, the song is a breakup song, right? But this sense of, you know, I can eat my dinner at a fancy restaurant, I can see whomever I choose, right? I can, any possible consolation available to the speaker is nothing, right? Because nothing compares to you. Yes, the song is definitely a breakup song, but it is not only that. And to push the point further, perhaps no breakup song is only that.
Perhaps no breakup song is only a breakup song. This was a moment in Paul's talk that really brought me some clarity about my music listening habits and why some of the songs I've become most attached to describe experiences I've never had. When Bruce Springsteen sang about hard times in industrial towns, I was able to at least partially resolve my feelings about changes big and small happening around me that I couldn't control. And that's why I find breakup songs so powerful and so well worth our time. Because, as I said earlier, we have all experienced some form of loss, grief, and the false consolations that can't replace what's missing. And in those moments, none of us are very good rationalists. I don't know about you, but I've never found an academic book that helped me through a hard time as much as a good song. And maybe the song doesn't even have to be, quote, good, like we've come to think of what good is. Although Paul introduced song lyrics in general as the kind of poetry that doesn't get much play in universities, Nothing Compares to You is a pretty safe choice. Most music critics would consider it to be good art, and the artists behind it to be good artists. But is a song or band the critics think of as, quote, bad, just as good, if it connects with you in a meaningful way? Let's cut to the chase. What I'm saying is I will happily twist Paul Dick's sublime academic analysis of Sinead O'Connor to validate your love of Nickelback if those songs make you feel something too. The views and opinions expressed here do not necessarily represent those of Dr. Paul Dick or CMU. I'm ranting, but it's related. The idea that poetry can mean something to you, whether the profs and critics like it or not, gets me back to the second question I started with. How poetry as a way of knowing can point out some of the limits of academic analysis, or methods that assume the scholar must separate themselves from the subject matter, to deal with it objectively, rather than to frame learning as a shared experience like poetry is. We know, but we are also known at the same time. Elsewhere in his lecture, Paul says the French philosopher Maurice Merleau-Ponty found this relational knowledge to be a fundamental part of being human. And Paul illustrates this with an exercise about, well, letting your right hand know what your left hand is doing. Try this with him before we wrap this up.
Merleau-Ponty describes the way that we know each other as being like the way our left hand knows our right hand. We like to imagine that we know things objectively from a distance. We have knowledge about things, right? We know stuff. But for Merleau-Ponty, we know as we are known. So just do this with me. Reach out and touch your right hand with your left hand. Can you do it? Are you with me? Okay. Your left hand has knowledge of your right hand by touch. You can touch it and feel its knuckles and bones and the texture of the skin, right? But simultaneously, as your left hand is feeling, it is also being felt, right? Even as the left knows the right also knows the left.
This seems like a bit of a tangent, but to connect it with Nothing Compares to You and how we know things poetically, anytime you listen to a song, you're not just taking in information one way. You may know the song, but the song also knows you, or invites you into a different way of knowing yourself. And so, by listening to music, you are practicing a very important way of being human. Through rhythm, rhyme, and repetition, we can feel our emotions more fully and make connections with others, who may have different stories, but share the experience of those same emotions. Paul talked there about the right knowing the left and vice versa. I couldn't help but think, are there political implications to these kinds of shared emotional experiences? Perhaps we can only hope. But I will say this, without learning to feel our feelings, it's much harder to be empathetic to others. So my encouragement to you as we end here, go listen to your favorite breakup song. Delight in your shared experience with the singer, whether or not the words describe what's happened to you, or maybe even to them. It's a great way to practice being more fully human, knowing while being known. Thank you to Dr. Paul Dick for this thought-provoking back-to-school poetry lesson. And thanks to you for staying with me as I tried to make some sense of it. If you want to share your favorite breakup songs with me, send a message to our Facebook page at facebook.com/sowhatpodcast. You can listen to past episodes and subscribe at cmu.ca/sowhatpodcast or wherever you like to get your podcasts. My name is Jonas Cornelson. Thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you in December.